Russia unleashes a renewed offensive on Ukraine's eastern front, but attacks in the west have not completely stopped.
These attacks on Lviv in particular are an attempt by Russians to show that no part of Ukraine is safe.
We have the latest on Russia's war. Also on the program, in Saudi Arabia, Uyghurs face deportation to China, despite human rights abuses likely waiting for them there.
It is unconscionable knowing that Saudi Arabia does not even raise a finger to the Chinese.
And I speak with a Congolese musician who is not kidding when he says he's attached to his guitar.
I made my own guitar when I was like 7 years old.
You built a guitar at the age of seven?
Yeah, the first guitar was like one string.
Five strings later and a lot of attention to his YouTube videos, Jason Tamba has his first album. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. The Russian military has escalated its battle for control of eastern Ukraine in what both sides are calling a new phase of the war. For weeks, Russia has been increasing its focus on the Donbas region of eastern and southern Ukraine. Over the last 24 hours, its military expanded its artillery and bombing campaign on cities, towns, and villages in that region, including civilian populations. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Russian troops have launched the battle for Donbas.
Це питання тільки часу, коли вся територія нашої держави буде звільнена.
Zelensky added, it's only a matter of time until all of Ukraine is liberated. For the latest from Ukraine, we have Olga Tokariuk on the line. She's a reporter and a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. She joins us from the western part of Ukraine. Many are calling this attack on the long eastern front a second phase of this war, Olga. How would you describe it?
Yes, well, this attack has been announced by Russia for some time, and it has been expected for the last days and weeks. And it is definitely the second phase of the war. Russia has failed to achieve its stated objectives in the first initial phase of the war. It failed to capture Kyiv, to capture Kharkiv, two of the biggest Ukrainian cities. It also failed to capture actually any major Ukrainian city with the exception of Kherson in southern Ukraine. So instead, Russia is concentrating now its efforts on occupying all territory of Donetsk and Luhansk regions, currently about a third of the territory of these regions is under Russian control. And potentially we might also expect another assault on Kharkiv. Kharkiv has been under heavy Russian bombardment in the last days. So Russians might be also trying to capture Kharkiv to make a second attempt to capture it.
At the same time, Olga, Russia has targeted areas throughout Ukraine, not just in the east. That includes Dnipro and Lviv, which is all the way in western Ukraine. How do you explain this?
Yes, Russia has been launching missile strikes on major Ukrainian cities throughout the country, including in western Ukraine. Western Ukraine is currently the region to which millions of internally displaced people flocked from various parts of Ukraine, where heavy fighting is underway, also from Kyiv. In Lviv itself, at least 500,000 people arrived from different regions of Ukraine. And of course, Lviv region houses many more. Millions, actually, of Ukrainian IDPs. So these attacks on Lviv in particular are an attempt by Russians to show that no part of Ukraine is safe, that even those people who fled from Donbas, from southern Ukraine to other parts of the country cannot feel safe there. And of course, Russia having a superiority at air and being able to launch missiles without Ukraine having adequate air and missile defense systems can do that freely and can continue its intimidation tactic and also as an attempt to force Ukrainian government into concessions, into, you know, also trying to break up the spirit of this Ukrainian resistance that inspired so many across the world.
I'm speaking with Olga Tokariuk, a reporter and a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. She's in western Ukraine. We know that many civilians have been encouraged to evacuate the Donbas region. Do we know how many have left and how many are still there?
Well, I do not have exact figures. I know that every day when the humanitarian corridors were working, and they haven't been for the last 3 days because of the dangers of Russian shelling, about 2,000 or 3,000 of people were evacuated from eastern and southern Ukraine. I think this is not a very impressive number, considering that millions of people live there. There were problems, of course, with evacuation by railways after an attack on Kramatorsk train station by Russian forces about 2 weeks ago when 57 people died. And there was some reluctance also on behalf of the civilian population to take trains. Then more people were evacuated by buses and by private cars. For many people who are still there in eastern Ukraine, actually some of my relatives still remain in Donetsk region, and they are unwilling to evacuate because they are afraid of all these risks connected to evacuation. And also a lot of people, especially elderly, they are reluctant to get evacuated because they say, well, I don't want to abandon my house. I will stay here no matter what happens. I just hope that nothing bad happens to me.
Have you been in touch with those relatives, Olga? And what do you say to them at this point?
Well, my other relatives were in touch, because these people are of an older age, so they rather speak to and listen to, you know, people of the same age. And we were trying also like to, you know, appeal to their reason. But especially after this attack on Kramatorsk train station, it has become hard to convince them and to talk to them, because they say, well, even if I try to evacuate, it doesn't guarantee my safety. It's also hard, you know, to persuade them, because somehow you take this responsibility of saying them that everything will be good if you evacuate or if you try to get evacuated, but you cannot guarantee. So ultimately, this is the choice that a person makes, and no one can, and no one even has a moral right somehow to assume this responsibility and to decide that, well, do this because this will be better for you. We don't know actually whether it would be better. We cannot guarantee the security of this person. So it's heartbreaking to know that my relatives are there in Donetsk region, that they might come under fire. They are aware of the risks, but it's very hard to tell them, well, go try to get evacuated. It will be better for you if the evacuation is not safe and if they might get killed during an evacuation.
So difficult, such a dilemma. Finally, Olga, we heard President Volodymyr Zelensky a moment ago from comments he made yesterday. He said it's only a matter of time until all of Ukraine is liberated. Do you believe him?
Well, I want to believe him definitely as a Ukrainian, because I know that millions of lives are at stake. We've seen what happened in the areas of northern Ukraine that were under Russian occupation for months. I'm speaking about Bucha, obviously, but also about other parts of Kyiv, Chernihiv, Sumy region. We've seen all the terrible crimes that were committed there by the Russian occupying forces, extrajudicial killings, execution of civilians, torture, rape, including of children. There are grounds to believe that similar things are currently happening in the occupied parts of southern Ukraine. There are reports of kidnappings, abductions, torture, and extrajudicial killings in Kherson region, in occupied parts of Zaporizhia and Mykolaiv region. So it's not surprising that President Zelensky says that Ukraine should be striving to liberate all of Ukraine's territory, because Russian occupation does not mean safety for Ukrainians who live there. On the contrary, Russian occupation means terror, means repression, means rape and killings. And of course, you know, it's a noble goal of the Ukrainian military to restore order and restore dignity and avoid more loss of life and just pay respect to basic human rights.
Olga Tokariuk is a reporter and a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis, speaking with us from Western Ukraine about the latest in the second phase of Russia's war against the country. Olga, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention dropped do-not-travel advisories for 90 countries today. Travel restrictions and bans throughout the pandemic have been very charged, very political, and at times strayed away from the science. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for our show and joins us. What does this change mean, Alana?
Well, the highest level of COVID advisories is level 4. It's red, and it means do not travel. And if you were to look at a global map right now, there's no more red countries. Instead, many are now bright orange, which represents level 3. It means the risk for COVID is still high and that people should avoid traveling to these places if they're not up to date on COVID-19 vaccinations.
So what is the thinking behind the shift to lift all these travel advisories?
Well, scientists are changing the way they assess COVID threats. And until now, the do not travel level, that red level, was based on case counts. Now, scientists say that will be reserved for special situations, like if cases shoot up really fast in a place or if a new variant of concern emerges. And level 3 will now be based more on whether cases have been stable and then increased or decreased over about a one-month period.
And what does that mean for the spread of the virus? I mean, last I checked, COVID is still very much present.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that researchers, though, have learned is that travel bans, the way they've been enacted, they really don't work. You know, they have to be across the board and they have to happen fast and early. And what we've seen in the U.S. and Canada and Europe throughout this pandemic is they've often gone into effect in really patchy ways that happens too late. And instead, it just winds up damaging countries on those lists. Like, you might remember that ban only on southern African countries when Omicron was first identified, but the virus was already spreading everywhere.
So, Ilana, there's another big part to this travel story. A federal judge in Florida has struck down mask mandates on planes and other transit here in the U.S. What does that mean for global travel and for taming the virus?
So I asked Saad Omer about this. He directs Yale's Institute for Global Health. And he happened to be traveling on Amtrak when we spoke earlier today, where masks are now optional.
As I travel from D.C. to New Haven, this is the biggest chunk of people who are unmasked.
So he says that most people are masked, but there's a lot more people that maybe have their masks below their nose, things like that. And he worries about this because it goes against current guidance from the CDC. And he says it's really important that federal scientists have this ability to make quick policy decisions based on changes in the virus and its spread. And this court decision overrides that.
It's not necessarily more restrictive policies or less restrictive policies that are effective. It is the right kind of policies that are effective. And so, unfortunately, this ties CDC's hands, at least in the short run.
And what about in other places outside the U.S.? What's happening with masking and other travel policies in different countries right now?
So it really varies from place to place, and actually airline to airline and airport to airport. Jeffrey Lazarus is a public health researcher at IS Global in Spain. I called him up because he travels a lot in Europe and the U.S.
I mean, it's so confusing to go on to Ryanair or American Airlines and figure out what you need. I'm getting on a bus on Sunday and they're requiring a negative antigen test, but they accept the self-test. That's in Germany. I mean, everyone has a different policy.
He says France has lifted masks, but you still have to show your COVID vaccine passport. If you're traveling on British Airways, you don't need to wear masks unless you're arriving in a country that requires them. That's similar to what this new federal ruling may mean in the U.S. And Lazarus says these changes, especially lifting masking in public settings and on transportation, it's a risk and it's a political decision. Airports are natural environments for mixing for a new variant if it were to emerge to really take off. And Omicron can still be serious.
People are still ending up in hospital. People are still getting sick. And you should have a right to avoid that.
You know, planes do have good air ventilation and masks are a really important part of preventing infections. But that doesn't totally get rid of risks, especially if others aren't masked.
Yeah, it does seem there's very little harmonization anywhere. The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Marco.
The plight of Uyghur Muslims in China has been well documented as they face persecution by the Chinese government. The case of a Uyghur mother and her daughter in Saudi Arabia have brought that problem into sharper focus. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A group of Uyghur people face deportation from Saudi Arabia to China. Among them are a mother and her 13-year-old daughter. Activists have so far managed to stall their deportation, saying if they go back, their lives will be in danger. But as The World's Shirin Jafari reports, it's not clear if they'll continue to be allowed to stay in the kingdom.
An online video shows a woman in the back of a car. It's dark, so we only get glimpses of the woman in a black hijab. This is my daughter, a voice says. We are inside a police car. She says they are being escorted by several other police cars and that they are being taken to the airport to be deported. Please save us. Please save us quickly, she pleads. The video set off alarm bells across the world. Activists, NGOs, and human rights groups started a campaign to stop the deportation.
We were quite shocked to see the video.
Alkan Akad is China researcher with Amnesty International.
We know that if they were sent back to China, they would be facing arbitrary detention. They would be taken to those internment camps where they would face risk of torture as well as persecution.
There is considerable and reliable evidence that the government in Beijing is committing human rights violations against the Uyghurs, Akad says. These range from forcibly putting them in so-called re-education camps and subjecting them to forced labor, torture, sexual assault, and sterilization. Some Uyghur people have simply disappeared, like the more than 90 relatives of Aydin Anwar, who is Uyghur-American. In a talk she gave at Duke University last year, Anwar listed some of the reasons that could get Uyghurs in trouble with the Chinese government.
Abstaining from alcohol, praying, fasting, going to a mosque, telling others not to sin, having too many children, having WhatsApp.
The list goes on, she says. Several countries, including the United States, have called China's actions against the Uyghurs genocide. But other nations have looked away or worse. That includes many Muslim-majority countries. That's shocking to Nuri Terkel. He is with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Over the years, particularly in the last 3-4 years, the Chinese Communist Party have been actively recruiting, enlisting support from the Muslim countries. And Saudi Arabia has been one of the key players in this.
During a 2019 visit to China, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told his hosts that his country respects and supports China's right to take, quote, counterterrorism measures. The Saudis also endorsed China's policies in 2 joint letters to the United Nations.
It is unconscionable knowing that Saudi Arabia and this particular Saudi leader does not even raise a finger to the Chinese.
The Saudi consulate in Washington did not respond to my request for comment for this story. But it's not only the Saudis, Turkey says. Pakistan, Iran, Syria, and even the Palestinian authorities have sided with Beijing. Turkey says China has presented a soft image of itself in many Muslim-majority countries.
What they did is do things like building schools, roads, and hospitals, saying that where the West bomb your cities and kill your people, we're here to build your country.
And then there are the economic ties. The Chinese are buying silence from these countries, Terkel says.
Some of these Muslim countries believe mistakenly that they can use China to counter Western influence, the United States in particular.
Human rights groups believe the 4 Uyghurs are still in Saudi Arabia, but they say they don't know much about where they are or how they are being treated. Amnesty International's Alkan Akad says none of the Uyghurs facing deportation have been charged with a crime. And that one thing is absolutely clear. They do not want to go back to China.
Even one of the detainees told the authorities that they would rather die in Saudi Arabia than be sent to China.
For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Since 2002, the project Playing for Change has gone around the world, recording musicians as they play together on one well-known song in their own styles. It started with Stand By Me, the Benny King classic, followed by scores of other tunes recorded in more than 50 countries with over 1,000 different artists. We wanted to introduce you to one of them. This is Congolese guitarist Jason Tamba, who signed up for Playing for Change's cover of Bob Marley's legendary track, War No More Trouble. Now Jason Tamba has stepped out from behind Playing for Change and released his first solo album, Don't Give Up. Getse Mane is the title of this track, and Jason Tamba joins us from Los Angeles. Jason, let's start with your experience with Playing for Change. You've been able to travel to over 25 countries, spreading this musical message of hope and unity. What did all that give you?
People are just the same, you see? People have to be united and leave all the problems behind, you know? Some good stuff happening around all over the world, you know? When you talk to the people, you feel like, oh, we all of us the same, you know?
Well, you've spoken with a lot of people, also worked with some pretty famous names like Peter Gabriel, Angélique Kidjo, Bono, and now you've released your debut solo album. Was this something you had been wanting to do for a long time, to release an album of your own?
The idea of releasing an album was there a long time ago. I was really attached to the guitar. And then I made my own guitar when I was like 7 years old.
You built a guitar at the age of seven.
I built my guitar. The first guitar was like one string. And then I built a four string guitar when I was 10, 12 years old.
It feels like the title of your album, your solo album, Don't Give Up, it says a lot about you and just your outlook on life. Is that a perspective that you have just learned to live by? Like, don't give up.
Exactly. Since Congo, you know, from Congo until being in America, there is a story to tell, you know. I went through many things. Even that, I didn't stop working on my music, you know. That's like a piece of advice to give to the kids. Like, if you want to do something, don't give up. You have to be positive. Keep on doing that, no matter what's happening around you.
A great prescription for life. Congolese musician Jason Tamba there. His debut album is Don't Give Up. Training a practiced eye on traffic in the Bosphorus Strait can give you a window to the world.
Right now we see suddenly ships carrying hydrocarbon goods, like petrol, crude especially, to India. Bosphorus is a place you can follow the world.
Follow along with the ship spotters. We also have the latest on China's COVID lockdowns coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Since ancient times, the Bosphorus Strait has been one of the busiest and most strategic waterways in the entire world. It cuts through Turkey and connects the Black Sea with the Mediterranean and eventually the Atlantic Ocean. On any given day, the strait is crowded with ferries and fishing boats, cargo ships, and military vessels. That traffic is watched by ship spotters. Some are hobbyists, some professional analysts, and they use these movements to understand global geopolitics. As Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul, they're now watching the Bosphorus to understand how Russia is funding the war in Ukraine.
Living in Istanbul, you're always near the Bosphorus. You might take the ferry to work or walk on the shore to clear your head. You might sit by the water on a Friday night, the passing of the boats becoming a kind of meditation. But what you might not think about is where those boats are going, where they come from. But Yuruk Ishik does.
When there is an international crisis, I get famous. Then I don't like to get famous. I like to be forgotten.
I meet Ishik on the deck of a commuter ferry. He's a geopolitical analyst and the founder of Bosphorus Observer, a ship-spotting blog with a huge local following. These days, he's particularly interested in Russian oil tankers. Shut out by European markets, Russia is now selling fuel for lower prices to whomever will buy it.
Like right now, we see suddenly ships carrying hydrocarbon goods, like petrol, crude especially, to India. Like, it really follows. Bosphorus is a place you can follow the world.
Ishik carries a camera with a telephoto lens and keeps an app open on his phone to show him which boats to expect. He's watched as Gulf countries transported arms to fighters in Yemen, as Russia ran troops and supplies to its base in Syria, where it supports the regime of Bashar al-Assad. As we sail north towards the Black Sea, we pass a sprightly Turkish Navy boat dressed in a hazy warship gray.
Here is a small military ship is passing. We can take a picture of it.
In February, the Turkish government invoked the 1936 Montreux Convention, which bans foreign military ships from the Bosphorus and Dardanelles Straits during times of war. But Işık thinks this Turkish one is heading to a naval base along the Black Sea.
So this is probably carrying very light cargo, like daily supplies to the base, etc.
In the run-up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Işık watched as Russia used the Bosphorus to transfer Navy ships from its positions in the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, one at a time. Back then, the Russian government claimed it was for military exercises. Now, the world knows the truth.
Putin, since the day one, has been engaged in wars, but we continue to engage with Russia for energy security, and this is the result.
Turkish officials have vocally condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine and sold military equipment to the Ukrainian armed forces. But Turkey has stopped short of joining Western sanctions against Russia. The country is trying to walk a careful line between supporting Ukraine and not angering the Kremlin. The Turkish coast lies on just the other side of the Black Sea from Ukraine. And though the fighting is a good 600 miles away from Turkey, the waters here are facing a new threat, drifting naval mines in the Black Sea. When fishermen discovered one near Istanbul, Işık rushed to the scene.
These are all Soviet-era made mines, so by just looking at it, we cannot tell who it belongs.
This mine was safely detonated by the Turkish Navy. But early last month, an Estonian cargo ship sunk off the port city of Odessa after an explosion, possibly due to a stray mine. Four sailors remain missing. As mine sightings continue, Işık worries not just for the safety of people transiting the Black Sea, but also about the effect it could have on commercial shipping and the global economy.
There is already many ports are closed, and if this mine thing comes also, it will add for all big companies amazing price for the insurance, etc., which in turn it might make impossible for any legitimate company to operate.
For now, shipping continues in the Bosphorus Strait. Near the northern edge of the strait, we see a large oil tanker, heavy in the water.
It didn't declare any destination yet, so that is interesting. It's definitely carrying Russian crude, and so maybe it's carrying, but it doesn't have even buyer yet. It will. Sometime it happens. The ships carry crude, but the buyer comes later on.
Işık gets up to take a photo. He says he'll keep watching this one. It's a big ship, and it can't hide itself. In doing so, he's hoping to understand who is still buying Russian oil, coal, and other commodities. And, by extension, who is supporting the war. For The World, I'm Derya Buzkaran in Istanbul.
You can connect with The World 24/7, catch up with the latest stories on our website, including our ongoing coverage of the war in Ukraine, but also news you might have missed, like environmental coverage that focuses on solutions to the problems, and our story about comedian Nigel Ung, famous for roasting celebrity chefs who get the recipes of Asian dishes totally wrong. Those and more stories on our website, theworld.org. COVID lockdowns are spreading across China as the government there fights to contain the spread of the virus. 20 cities and regions are now in some form of lockdown. Most residents in China's most populous city, Shanghai, have been kept inside for 3 weeks. Among them is The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Canther. Rebecca, are things getting any better in Shanghai?
Well, the number of cases is on a slight downward trend for the past 4 days, so I think we're over the hump. But it's still almost 20,000 cases a day, which makes it the largest COVID outbreak since Wuhan in 2020. Part of the government's dynamic COVID strategy now is just trying to get all the positive cases into centralized quarantine so they can continue to ease the lockdown. Death rate is up, but I mean, when I tell you the number, it's so low here. The total number of deaths for this outbreak is 10. All of them were unvaccinated people. All were over 60 with underlying conditions.
What is the mood there right now, Rebecca? People must be getting really antsy.
Yeah, I would say people in Shanghai are fed up, and they are openly expressing their discontent. This video was circulating on WeChat on Friday. So what it's showing is a huge crowd of people who have broken lockdown rules and are protesting on the street. Police officers in head-to-toe protective gear are pushing them back. I don't want to give you the idea that there are mass protests on the streets of Shanghai. This was probably an isolated incident, but there are many disturbing videos circulating of individuals resisting being taken to quarantine centers and being treated with force. And so everyone is kind of fed up, including the poor public health workers who are tasked with carrying out all this testing.
Sure. So these lockdowns have spread across China. What can you tell us about what's happening in other parts of the country?
So other cities are also going into some form of lockdown. For example, Xi'an, which went through a month-long, very difficult lockdown a few months ago, they're now back in a partial lockdown. Businesses are still open, but people are being asked to stay home. And also, many other smaller cities are going into like a preventative lockdown. They might not have a lot of cases, but they don't want to become another Shanghai. So they are going into lockdown early. Other cities like Guangzhou hasn't gone into lockdown, but they are preventing inward travel. They're cutting off inward travel to Guangzhou and keeping all the students in online schooling and doing daily testing. So every different city is trying to take some kind of preventative measure because no one really wants to have a situation like we've got in Shanghai right now.
And back in Shanghai, what is the situation for testing?
Well, yeah, it's just more and more testing. I've been tested every day for the last few days. I mean, I don't mind. It's a chance to get outside and get some exercise. But they're just, you know, just trying to bring down the number of positive cases, get all those cases to quarantine locations. They're even opening classrooms and empty buildings as quarantine locations. Now, the top epidemiologist, Zhong Nanshan, he was advocating for a change in strategy, sort of living with COVID. But top leadership is still holding course. They really are wanting to keep going with this zero COVID strategy. But they also know they can't completely cut off production and basically strangle the economy. So, for example, they're giving companies like Tesla the opportunity to restart production. And so they're trying to prioritize certain companies to get back to work. But there's really no word on when I'll get let out. We got a government ration today of toilet paper, washing detergent, and soap. And that, to me, was a message that I could be in here for a while.
So a little more patience, I guess. Overall, how are you and your family holding up, Rebecca?
I think the real silver lining to this lockdown is that, you know, you're getting to know your neighbors and neighbors are joining forces to do these large bulk food buys. I sent out a text in our WeChat group where we do all of our group buys. And I said, does anyone have any celery? I want to make matzo ball soup. And my neighbor on the fourth floor actually lowered some celery down on a string for me. And that was a very funny experience.
Wow. Epic revelations during the pandemic. That's got to count for something. The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marco.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has declared a national disaster in response to last week's deadly flooding in the eastern region of KwaZulu-Natal. Ramaphosa addressed the nation yesterday as it continued to mourn the more than 440 people killed in those floods.
There are few words of comfort that can ease the pain and the anguish and the torment of those people who have lost their loved ones.
Ramaphosa said last week's heavy rains destroyed 4,000 homes and washed away roads and bridges. Dozens of people are still missing, and military and police forces are leading rescue missions. The floods hit poor neighborhoods the hardest, especially ones near swollen rivers. Busasiwe Diko is an organizer with a group in Durban called the Shack Dwellers Movement. She told us yesterday that government help hasn't arrived to those communities yet.
No government officials come and assess the situation in our communities.
Diko's organization advocates for people in informal settlements, people who have little option but to build their homes without government permission. She says that often means building on flood-prone land with scrap materials. Many homes in the neighborhood she represents were swept away by the flooding, she said, along with people inside.
And that resulted in many people that have died not being found.
Some neighborhoods in Durban are still without running water or electricity. When the rescue missions are over, Busasiwe Diko hopes South Africa works toward a longer-term solution, building more stable housing for poor residents.
We would like government to build enough decent houses for every South African citizen.
Up to 16 inches of rain fell in 24 hours in parts of eastern South Africa last week, the government says. 40,000 people have been displaced. And even as cleanup continues, more rains are expected this weekend. It has been 2 decades since revelations of widespread child sex abuse in the Catholic Church were first exposed here in the U.S. Since then, similar scandals have erupted across other parts of North America, Australia, and Europe. Many say Latin America, home to the world's largest Catholic population, could be next. The world's Tibisay Seya has more.
5 years ago, Eneas Espinosa learned he would become the father of a baby boy. He says this was a turning point for him, and he decided to go public about the trauma he suffered at the hands of Catholic priests. It was like an explosion inside of me that I couldn't stop, he says. Espinosa grew up in Chile and went to a Catholic school for 12 years, run by the Marist brothers. There, he says he was sexually abused multiple times by several priests. The first time happened when he was just 5 years old, he says.
¿Qué había pasado con mi espiritualidad? Me la quitaron siendo muy niño.
I never experienced any spirituality, he says. I'm an atheist to this day because I can't disassociate faith from abuse. It took him 4 decades to tell his story. Espinosa says the taboo of speaking out against child sexual abuse, especially if it involves the church, is a huge barrier for survivors in Latin America. He says his parents were very religious.
Mi familia es una familia católica. Mi mamá en esa época ella estuvo siempre trabajando gratis para los.
My mom used to work as a volunteer for the Marist brothers, he says. So I would keep hearing the name of the abuser at home, even after I finished school. He would call my mom and send greetings to me. When Espinosa decided to go public about his abuse, he joined a group of over 200 survivors in Chile. And in 2018, they met with Pope Francis when he visited the country. The Pope apologized to the victims and promised a formal investigation, but no one has been held to account so far.
Ninguna justicia. Mira, Adolfo Fuentes Corral, que es el hermano marista que me abusó primero.
Espinosa says his abusers are all free, and some of them were transferred to other countries in Latin America. Victor Sandes says this is not uncommon. He's a campaign organizer with the Child Rights International Network in the UK, and his group has documented more than 1,000 cases of abuse by clergy members in Latin America.
There will be many survivors, the vast majority won't be mobilized. They won't have any hope for change or justice in their cases. In most cases, the statutes of limitations will have expired, so they can't even go to court.
There are other barriers too, according to Sander. The separation between church and state isn't always very clear, he says, which means governments may hesitate to prosecute cases that involve the clergy. In other cases, victims have complained that Catholic bishops and priests have offered them money in exchange for silence. For all these reasons, many survivors are skeptical that sexual abuse cases will ever be prosecuted.
Something that often happens is that the church will announce its own commission of inquiry. This is a tactic, arguably, to deflect the attention from inquiries by a government or, in some cases, a law firm. And it's also a way of keeping control of the facts.
Sandes says international media could be instrumental in exposing the truth. Last month, the Spanish newspaper El País announced the first ever investigation into claims of abuse within the Catholic Church in Latin America. They're digging into more than 1,000 allegations. For the world, I'm Tibisay Seya.
Demand for oil plunged in 2020 during the height of pandemic lockdowns. Prices followed that downward trend. But since the war in Ukraine started, they've risen sharply and now top $100 a barrel. In Africa, high fuel costs and rising food prices are pinching consumers. But as Ridwan Karimdini Osman reports from the capital of Ghana, governments of oil exporting countries in the region could benefit.
At a local barber shop, a group of young men argue over the rising fuel prices that have adversely affected every facet of life here. The barber here, 22-year-old Daniel Fosu, intermittently weighs in on the discussion. He says his business has taken a nosedive.
Fuel and transportation are high because
since the fuel prices started going up, most of my customers now spend more than twice the amount we charge for the haircut on transport. Because of that, they have stopped coming. They say it doesn't make economic sense.
Filling up at the pump has become extremely expensive in Ghana. Fuel prices have shot up by more than 20% since January to $100 a barrel. But even before the crisis, Ghana had been grappling with a weakening local currency, which makes it more expensive to import fuel and has led to rising inflation across the board. The situation is hitting the pockets of people like Fosu very hard.
Life has become really unbearable. Where am I going to get the money to pay for the rent and my utility bills if things continue the way they are?
It is not the services sector alone that is taking a hit. At the Central Business District in Accra, Rose Lawson holds a sizable cane woven basket that is virtually empty. That's because food prices have more than doubled since she came to the same market 2 weeks ago.
And so with every increase in fuel prices, they have to pass on the cost to us. And they think we have the money, but we don't, because everything is rising except salaries.
Ghana's Peasant Farmers Association says food supplies will deteriorate if soaring transportation costs are not addressed. West Africa is currently experiencing its worst food crisis in a decade. Lawson says the only option left for her is to adjust the consumption pattern at home.
And that means that we have to reduce the intake of meat and now stick to cheaper alternatives, vegetables and other forms of protein, like beans, because that's all we can get. It's really, really been difficult.
Yet these tough times mean good business for oil-producing countries in Africa. Ghana, for instance, exported nearly $4 billion worth of crude oil last year.
And if you look at Ghana's case, where they did the budget on the basis of about $60 a barrel, now we're talking $100 or so a barrel, then the revenue is actually going to significantly improve.
Thus, Theo Echampong, an energy economist at the University of Aberdeen in the United Kingdom. He says while the current global surge looks good for governments in places like Ghana, it could worsen inflation in countries like Botswana, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique and South Africa, where transportation, food and beverages are a core part of household expenditure.
Surging oil prices, there are winners and there would be losers. The winners would be the commodity exporting ones, the net exporters, and the losers would be the net importers.
Echampong says after the US and Europe placed sanctions on Russian oil, it could have been a great opportunity for oil exporting African countries like Ghana, Nigeria and Angola to sell their crude oil in the international market. However, he says the problem is that Africa does not have sufficient refineries to meet demand. Nonetheless, Echampong says oil exporting countries in Africa should take steps to cushion domestic consumers.
If you take Angola as an example, we're probably, talking about 2.5 billion went for Nigeria, probably another 1.7 billion. And this is all money that could be used to subsidize domestic fuel prices.
Back at the market, Rose Lawson agrees.
Remove the taxes on the fuel prices. That may not, necessarily reduce the cost of the food, but it would definitely stabilize it.
For now, though, the Ghanaian government is not considering any subsidy on fuel. Economic watchers say prices could reach an all-time high by the end of 2022. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Psychedelic rock from Turkey. Where'd it come from? Most music experts point to the late 1950s. That's when early rock and roll from the U.S. began to travel around the globe, and everyone seemingly wanted to make that sound in their own way. Musically, rock and roll in the U.S. is all about the 4-4 beat. So when Turkish musicians took rock by the horns with their complex time signatures, 8-8, 10-8, 12-8, things were bound to get sonically funky. Now, some 60 years later, Turkish artists like this band Shatalites are still paying homage to that sound. Shatalites describe their quartet as a musical laboratory lost somewhere between the mysterious alleys of 70s Istanbul and the scorching sun and crystal blue sea of Jaffa, Tel Aviv. We wrap up with Disco Arabesque from the band's first full album, which dropped this month. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.